Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How would you have made out in the Victorian era? For those of modest means, the workdays were long, tedious, and often dangerous. From the time the knocker-upper man rapped on your window to wake you in the morning until the time you crawled into bed as a way to stay warm in the bleak of winter. Women laced themselves into corsets every day. Teachers felt free to beat their students. And if you wanted to take care of your teeth, you mixed up a nice paste of cuttlefish and soot to do the job. No wonder they drank beer for breakfast. The ideas and conditions that shaped Victorian life seem so different from those that guide us today that the period is endlessly fascinating to study. And my guest has actually experienced many Victorian customs and technologies firsthand. Ruth Goodman is a historian of British social and domestic life and author of How to Be a Victorian, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Victorian Life. Ruth, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
There are lots of ways to approach history. So many times, though, we think about famous people and big events. How did you become interested in day-to-day life instead?
I think because I'm not particularly a big person, if you know what I mean. I always wanted to know, what was it like for, you know, people like me, people like you, people like us? I've always felt slightly alienated by the idea that history is all about celebrity figures, the big, important people with the titles and the money and so forth. I've always felt that had very little to do with me. History surely is about us, not them.
We tend to talk about the Victorian era as a sort of monolithic moment in time, but in fact, Queen Victoria was on the throne for decades, and this book surprised me.
It's a very long period.
There's so much evolution in technology and innovation.
I think so. And I think when most of us think about the Victorian period, we're really thinking about the very end of it. Indeed, many of the things that we sort of discuss as being Victorian are, in fact, 20th century rather than 19th century. And when you start looking at the whole of it, all you're seeing is change at an incredible rate in every aspect of life and ideas.
One major area of technological development was in, to be blunt, toilets. Can you talk about how people's options evolved?
I think it's one of the most fascinating areas, really. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the WC, the water closet, the flushing loo and the drains. We get told a lot about that. But that's very late in the history, the early part of the Victorian period. We were still managing with earth closets, with privies. And out in the countryside, that's not a problem. If there's not too many people around, then digging a hole at the end of the garden, filling it in when it gets full, moving to a new spot and digging another hole is perfectly hygienic. Perfectly sanitary, and if you keep it all clean, which you can do quite easily, it's not particularly unpleasant either. You know, it's fine. But as soon as you start getting people living very close together in high concentrations, that just doesn't work. And what happened in London, particularly as the most concentrated place on earth at that time, was that the soil itself became utterly saturated with sewage, so that it seeped through. And if you lived in a cellar dwelling, it actually would come through the walls. It was just—it's just disgusting beyond belief, isn't it? And the very first attempts within the Victorian period to sort this out were sort of almost counterproductive. What ended up happening was that the new water closets, instead of allowing all this filth to fall into the earth, swished it into the rivers instead. So we sort of went from a position in which the earth that the London was built on was saturated with waste to a position where it was the waterways that were saturated with waste. And that took quite some time for people to realise that they'd simply changed from one problem to another problem, and then they had to do the drains. So it's a sort of a long evolution as more and more and more people get crammed into smaller and smaller spaces, and people are sort of looking at the problem and trying to work out, what the heck do you do?
You could hire somebody to remove some of this waste, but sometimes they would have to carry it back out through your house.
Yeah, well, that had long been the system within London. From about the late medieval era, there was already so many people in London that the cesspit simply filled and there was nowhere to build any new ones. So you had these people who had various names, dunny farmers, gong farmers, night soil men. There's a whole host of names who you could pay, and they would come in and dig it all out and take it away. And they were only allowed to work by night so that they didn't get in the way of people in the streets. But, of course, many people's access to their privy was through their house. So that was the only way of getting it back out again. It all had to be dug out by hand and then carried all the way through to be taken onto carts and then loaded onto barges to be shipped out to the countryside where it could be turned into compost. A pretty smelly, difficult business.
The Victorian era seems to have been a really challenging time, simply if you were not wealthy. For one thing, at least in England, it was cold a lot of the time.
Yeah, we do damp and grey. There's no doubt about it. And I'm certainly, as someone who's tried to live the Victorian life, the cold is the thing that I find hardest. I don't have too much trouble giving up many of the, you know, sort of peripheral things of modern life. I'm very happy without a mobile phone. You know, I positively jump with delight at not having to use the internet. But being cold all the time is no fun at all. And it takes so much energy. You know, everything you do is an effort because you're cold, because your hands are frozen before you even start putting them in the cold water to do the job that you've got to do. You know, everything's an effort about keeping warm.
I remember reading books as a child, and I had to continually look up the definition of this thing called chilblains, which I suppose were like a major thing that people had to deal with.
I can tell you all about chilblains. Flipping hurts. It's basically the veins at your extremities become damaged by the cold, so they swell right up. And that's quite bad when they're cold. But as soon as you get somewhere slightly warm, then they seem to burn, and it is like being on fire. It's not nice.
I guess part of the problem, too, was that nutritious food was hard to come by. One thing that I did not expect, Ruth, was that people in working in factories actually tended to eat better than agricultural laborers.
Yeah, well, that's why people made the move. I mean, we often think we have, an image of the difficulties of factory life. But you have to remember, people chose to go there in huge numbers. This enormous move of population away from the countryside into the factories. And because there was simply a little bit more money, and that meant a little bit more food. And if you are genuinely on the edge of hunger permanently, you will do almost anything for an extra couple of mouthfuls.
At what age were children in working class families expected to start working outside the home?
Well, that varies again through this massively long period. It's worst at the very beginning because traditionally in Britain, if you went back to the 16th and 17th century, you'd find that most children were not working full time until they were about 14, although they would sort of do a certain amount of work from about 10 onwards. It would only be quite small scale and usually based around the home. And at 14, then they consider their working life to really begin. But when the Industrial Revolution happened in the 18th century, we suddenly had a new need for unskilled labour. There were suddenly all sorts of jobs that needed very, very simple jobs that needed doing. Those very early machines, things went wrong with them all the time. They needed hand threading and hand laying out and hand connecting, and you know, they needed lots of tending. It was very unskilled work. It was not adding much value to the product, so it was always going to be very poorly paid. And with this new huge demand for this sort of labour, children filled the gap. So the sort of average starting age fell and fell and fell and fell. So when Queen Victoria comes to the throne, it was quite common for six-year-olds to be in full-time work.
Can you help me understand this, Ruth? Because I've read things like this before and I understand it, but I have raised six-year-olds and it's not that they're so recalcitrant, but I mean, it's sort of hard to keep them focused for a long time.
Yeah, that is true. And the stories that one comes back from the children who in later life wrote it down highlight that they themselves got bored and tired. And people used physical corporal punishment to keep them nose to the grindscale. They hit them. I mean, there's no nice way of saying it. The jobs were often the sort of jobs, too, where there were fewer distractions. So the very smallest children who were down the mines, for example, were just plonked in a corner in the dark on their own to open a trapdoor. There was nothing else down there in the total blackness. There is nothing. They can't see anything. They can't talk to anybody. They are alone in the dark. The only interaction they get is when somebody comes and then they've got to pull the flap to open. Well, you know, you don't if the child's in that situation, they're probably only too glad to open that flap and talk to somebody as they walk past. A lot of small children of that age were also sort of out in the fields doing things like picking stones or scaring birds. And again, fairly easy to keep a child at those tasks because it's very episodic work. It's not like sort of organised work that an older child might manage.
We should let people know this entire conversation won't be quite this bleak, but I do want to ask, do you think that generation of children, did they grow up damaged? I mean, can you imagine children today?
I think so. Their bodies were definitely damaged. There's absolutely no doubt about that. When you look at people's accounts, they discuss about the state of their bodies, but also you can see it in the skeletons that have been archaeologically examined. And you could see it in the health records and indeed in the economic records of the period. And basically what happened was a young person of about, particularly a man of about 19, was at the peak of his earning power. He was already out-earning his father. And that was simply because his father, having started at the age of 6, was physically broken down by the age of 40. And that's what it did to your body. It meant that nowadays, you know, a full working life, one can still be hale, fit, healthy, doing quite heavy physical work if you need to in 60. People at 40 in the Victorian period had such a hard start that they were never going to be able to carry on working at that rate.
And you could tell rich people from poor people often by how tall they were.
Yes, huge differences. I mean, at the time, commentators were saying that there was a 6-inch height difference between a 12-year-old boy at Eton and a 12-year-old boy in the East End slums of London.
How did people get up in the morning before everybody had an alarm clock?
That's back to your knocker-upper that you mentioned earlier. Right. It's a marvellous sort of occupation.
It's a great name,
God.
Too.
It is a great name, isn't it? It's a marvellous occupation. It was somebody who would stay up all night and they would have some sort of timepiece. Well, timepieces were rare and expensive. So, you know, the possession of a timepiece was important. You would then be armed with either a long cane or a handful of peas. Some people use a little pea shooter. And you would have a whole range of clients in the town who all needed to get up at different times in the morning for all the various jobs they would do. And when it was time to wake them, you went along to their bedroom window outside. Obviously, you stood in the street. And you either tapped on the window or you threw peas at it. You're hopefully knocking up just the person who needed to get up rather than waking the whole household. That's why you're not banging on the front door. That's why you're tapping on the bedroom window.
Were they expected to wait there and make sure that somebody wasn't?
Nope. No. It was, you know, they were just paid for that couple of taps and then on they go to their next client.
And a work day, not for the knocker-upper, I suppose, but for others was 16 hours sometimes?
Yeah, generally, yeah. Work hours sort of vary, and again, it changes over the whole Victorian period, partly with the ebbs and flows of international business, so that there are times in which there's pressure for everybody to work longer hours and times when there's less pressure. So it sort of flows around a bit. But 16 hours was quite normal.
And that was 5 days a week, 6 days a week?
6 days a week.
Wow. Mm. Ruth Goodman is my guest. She's a historian of British social and domestic life and author of the new book, How to Be a Victorian, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Victorian Life. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. By the way, this is a little bit later in history, but for fans of Downton Abbey, there are some sneak peek events at Fort Worth's Ridgely Theater on Saturday, December 13th. There's also one at the Winspear in Dallas on Sunday, December 14th. That one's already sold out. You might check those out online and see if you'd like to go. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ruth Gordon. She's a historian of British social and domestic life, and she has a new book out called How to Be a Victorian, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Victorian Life. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Ruth, this book has made me promise never to complain about doing laundry ever again with my washing machine in my
dryer. Life's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah. What was it like to wash clothes back then?
Hard blinking work. I think there is nothing like a quick spell in the past for making you appreciate the joys of the 21st century. And the washing machine, as far as I'm concerned, is right up there, straight after the birth control pill. That's the next most important aspect of female liberation, as far as I can work out.
It was an all-day thing.
It was a huge amount of labour. And it came about as a result of the change from wood as our main fuel to coal as our main fuel. We used to use wood, and wood ash is a natural detergent. It's an alkali, and we used to do our laundry by using this wood ash combined with cold water, beating things down the stream. Everything came out lovely and clean, didn't cost you a penny. And then we had to change over to coal. There were simply too many of us. We couldn't, you know, we ran out of wood, basically. We had to start burning coal. And coal does not produce the same beautiful free detergent. So suddenly we had to buy soap. And if you have to buy soap, Victorian soap only activates in hot water. So suddenly we were trapped in this position where, instead of being able to just take dirty laundry in a dry, very light, easy to carry way down to the stream, washing it and coming back with it, suddenly we had to move all of this water ourselves in buckets, haul it somewhere where we could heat it. And then when we'd finished the washing process, we had to haul it all away again. It created an enormous amount of extra work on top of the actual business of rubbing and scrubbing.
How clean were the Victorians?
Oh, gosh, that's a difficult question, isn't it? I mean, you know, how did you quantify clean? I mean, how clean are you? How clean am I? How clean are any of us? It's really difficult to say. And there must have been huge differences. Mm-hmm. You know, one person's standards are completely different from another person's standards. And one person's time and equipment is completely different from another person's time and equipment. They certainly minded about cleanliness. There's absolutely no doubt about that. They wanted to be as clean as they possibly could. But, you know, there are limitations. When it takes you a whole 12 to 14 hour day's labour to do a load of washing for the family, you know, you get a bit more sort of cagey about how often you change the sheets, don't you? You're not quite so keen to wash that shirt every day. You know, I think the huge volume of it, the amount of labour that was involved, did tend to make people stretch things out a bit.
The thought of making every stitch of clothing my family wears sounds incredibly tedious to me. But in fact, Victorian women and girls found sewing to be a break from all the other stuff they had to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it is like so many of these things. You know, you have ideas about the Victorian past, and it's only when you find yourself doing all of this stuff and living this sort of regime that you begin to see things through their eyes rather than through our eyes. And that's one of the things I find most exciting about the exploration of social and domestic history and exploring it through doing it. And if you've spent, you know, one day on your feet laundering, and you most of your work is on your feet hauling things, either coal and water, in and out and in and out, and that's just for the basics of survival before you even think about paid work, then the chance to sit down and work on something small that isn't heavy is, oh, what a delight. What a relief. I think also an awful lot of people found a certain intimacy in the sewing. You know, it was something you did together, something you did socially with other close members of your family. Many people seem to have had very warm feelings about sewing time with their mothers and sisters. And it can be quite creative too, can't it?
And everybody was expected to know how to do it. This was not something that was sort of optional.
No. It was like, Well, it was more normal than knowing how to use a telephone. I mean, it was the sort of real base level skill everybody could sew, including men. But men could only probably do a little, they did a little bit of it when they were small. They could do the bit of basics. Almost every man in the whole of society could sew on a button or, you know, repair a small tear in his clothes if he needed to. But the majority of sewing was done by women, and was something that you would spend a very large part of your education learning. I mean, if you were to add up all the sort of hours of teaching that a Victorian girl received, you'd find that sewing probably took up as much as reading and writing put together, and certainly way more than any mathematics that they ever got.
All right, I want to talk about corsets, because these have been much maligned, right, by later generations of women, but I get the sense that that Victorian women saw them as much as markers of respectability as vanity.
Yeah, I think so. And there is something to be said for wearing them. I quite like them, actually. I have had problems when I lace too tight. But in general, given the choice between a well-fitted corset and a bra, I would choose the corset.
Why?
I actually think it's comfier. because it holds you sort of all over, as opposed to being in just a few points. Because a bra, you know, all the tension in a bra is concentrated in a couple of places. And I don't know about other people, but I get quite sore when elastic and so forth. Whereas a bra, because it holds you all over, a corset holding you all over, it's all right. It's like a sports bra, but not as sweaty as a sports bra, because, of course, it's not made of anything plastic.
Yeah. And there were doctors who actually said, this is healthy for you to wear a
corset. Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. It was considered that a woman didn't have the necessary core body strength. I mean, that's a modern phrase. But they really believed that women didn't have sufficient body strength to cope without corsetry, that they would endanger their health if they weren't completely loose and uncorseted. And more importantly, as you raised just a moment ago, it would endanger their morals too. There was a very strong connection between the control that a corset gave and self-control, that a woman would have more self-respect if she was corseted. And you know, women who were in institutions for reform, you know, prisons or workhouses and so forth, were issued with corsets because it was part of the regime. It was part of the way that you would become a better person.
So Victorians were certainly weird about sex, but they weren't necessarily prudish across the board.
Well, no, not necessarily. If you read sort of Victorian newspapers, some of the things that are there in print really can make you go, oh, surely not. I mean, there are letters to the Times. I don't know how much I'm allowed to say here.
You can describe anything in polite language.
Okay, righty-ho. Well, so there are letters to the Times all about the dangers and evils of masturbation, for example, in quite plain language, you know, there on the page. I can't imagine that a major newspaper would carry such a discussion in quite the same way now. You know, we might talk about other aspects of sex, but things like prostitution and masturbation were very widely spoken about. And indeed, prostitution in particular was very much a theme of the more religious press, the more aimed at a religious audience that a magazine or a publication was, the more likely it was to talk about prostitution, obviously saying it was a terrible thing. But, you know, quite a lot would be talked about it, a lot of detail would be gone into, there would be huge fundraising efforts to try and help set up homes for fallen women, there would be an awful lot of fiction about young women getting into trouble. It was quite a topic of conversation.
Was there more prostitution per capita then?
Well, who knows? I mean, do we actually know how much there is now, let alone how do we quantify? The Victorian figures are very difficult. I mean, as I say, modern figures are hard enough. There was the Bishop of London at one point seemed to think that one in five women in London was a prostitute, which I think
Goodness.
Is a bit of an exaggeration. I think he got his figures wrong there. The police reports were less than a tenth of that. But even so, they're sort of suggesting that maybe one in 50 of women of a suitable age were involved in prostitution, which is an awful lot.
Mm. Of course, there weren't, beyond about age 12, people didn't recommend any other education for girls, right?
Well, not for a long period. It's really only towards the very end of the Victorian period that you start getting higher and then eventually up tertiary education for women. One of the problems was thought to be a health issue. Many people believe that the energy, the sort of vital spirit that you needed to grow and develop could be expended or run out in many ways. So that if a young woman, when she hit puberty, overused her brain, it would have a detrimental effect on her body. That in a sense, the energy would be taken by her mind and leave her body short. So many people felt very strongly that although it was fine for a girl to be educated alongside her brothers up to about 11 or 12. From that point onwards, she should take a back seat. She should intellectually rest and allow puberty to happen unencumbered by any sort of thinking at all. And it took a long time for that worry to gradually fade away.
What was courtship like for the Victorians?
Oh, well, I think it varied enormously depending on class. You see, we have evidence, for example, in the East End of London of an almost counterculture of courtship, which involved young men and women who were very poor indeed, who had been out on the streets earning a living since they were 5 or 6 years old, reaching their teens and looking basically for a bit of fun and sex, same as you might expect they would. They were often heavily using alcohol at that by that age. So you get sort of in the East End a sort of courtship, which is surprisingly modern. It's about 15, 14-year-olds meeting each other out in groups in the street, a little bit of, you know, flirtation going on. And by the time they're sort of 16, they're in sort of one relationship, which then tails out, and they move on to another relationship, which lasts a little while and tails out. Very much not the pattern, perhaps, that one might expect. The upper classes or the middle classes, that sort of street opportunity is not there. Girls and boys are kept a bit more separate. Of course, many people are working together, aren't they? You know, I mean, it's only the very top end who are able, who really are kept separate. And we see different marriage ages in different groups. So we see the middle classes, the men are putting marriage off until they're about 30 and then choosing 20-year-old brides. Whereas amongst the sort of better off working class, those with jobs, decent jobs, managing to hold a home together, that sort of group tending to marry in their mid-20s, and both sexes about the same age. People are basically looking around them and themselves and sort of making quite sensible choices. They're sort of saying, well, you know, if they're at the very bottom, well, it's never going to get any better. I might just as well have a bit of fun now. If they're sort of, you know, doing okay in a working class sort of situation, and well, there might be an opportunity for putting a little bit aside, you know, getting a decent amount together to set up home. Those young couples are willing to wait a bit, you know? And then the top end, well, high quality living in Victorian Britain was extremely expensive. So it makes quite a lot of sense for a young man to hang off until he's 30, until he's established in a profession before he takes a wife. Whereas the families are busy, you know, the young women, they're under the pressure to find someone who can look after them, who can pay the bills as fast as possible. So you're seeing very different patterns in different groups of people.
With regard to sexual intercourse, there were rudimentary condoms tied on with a ribbon and reused.
Yeah. Well, they'd been around for quite some time. And in the 18th century, they were actually two specialist condom shops in London. And that's all they sold. But they were really there not to prevent pregnancy. They were there to protect men from venereal disease. So the sort of chap who used a lot of prostitutes could go along to the condom shop and have his nicely boxed up sheep gut condom, and he would soak it before use so that it became soft and malleable, and put it on, use it, and then afterwards rinse it all out and leave it to one side to dry again. And that worked fine if you had some sort of fairly stable mistress relationship. A bit harder for the casual sex, perhaps. But that, yes, there were condoms about.
Mm-hmm. What did it take to buy food that was of decent quality? Assuming that you had the money to buy food, you didn't quite know what you were getting, did you?
There was a lot of adulteration going on. There have always been sharp practices, haven't there? In any way you go, at any time, there have always been those who try and pass off poor quality goods as high quality goods for the high quality price. But the Victorian period saw a real intensification in things being padded out with a non-edible. So vast proportions of the flour on sale in British shops contained large quantities of chalk and of alum. And the actual amount of flour you got varied depending on how much you paid for it. Tea was adulterated, to some degree, in some of the adulterations. There was no actual tea left in it at all. People would gather blackthorn leaves, in particular dry blackthorn leaves, and then they would be dyed with red lead, which is poisonous, to make them look like tea. And that was sold, sometimes mixed in with tea, but sometimes entirely on its own. And obviously, the better class shop where you paid more money, you were less likely to have that sort of thing go on. But for, you know, a working class person who hasn't got much choice and needs the cheapest food available, they could be eating a lot of chalk.
It's no wonder they were malnourished.
No, exactly. Yeah. So many of the things in the Victorian period reach, you know, they take problems that had been going on for a long time and they reach a sort of absolute crunch point. It gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And then eventually it gets so bad, something has to be done about it. And so much of modern life is based on that something has to be done. So all the first regulations, all the first attempts to make sure that our food is pure and what it says on the packet, we owe that to the Victorians who first started doing chemical analysis and starting to do the very first lawmaking that said, you know, you must say what it is on the packet, you must, and what it says on the packet must be what is in the packet.
We're speaking this hour with British social and domestic historian Ruth Goodman, author of the new book, How to Be a Victorian, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Victorian Life. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults, from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ruth Goodman, who is a historian of British social and domestic life and author of the new book, How to Be a Victorian, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Victorian Life. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I didn't realize, Ruth, that Victorians were such enthusiastic consumers of cosmetic stuff in their hair, stuff on their faces, perfumes.
I know, it's quite amazing, isn't it? And so much of what is there is still in the modern products that we use today.
Like hairspray and pomade and things are not so different than hairspray and gel today.
No, they're not. I mean, when you start looking at the ingredients there, they're pretty much the same sort of product. What's different is the sorts of scents that are being chosen. So, I mean, there's a history of smell, just like there's a history of everything. And certain scents are fashionable at different times. And when Victoria first comes to the throne, the most fashionable scent was still eau de cologne, that sort of orangey smell, which had been very associated, however, with men rather than women. And as the Victorian period goes on, that becomes old-fashioned. And, you know, nobody wants that anymore. And they start looking instead for a sharper, more exotic sort of smell. And lemon and bergamot comes to the fore as a combination. And then a huge leap in technology. People discover how to synthesize an artificial lemon perfume out of coal tar, which is a rather unprepossessing start. But that what it means is that the price of this newly fashionable Victorian smell just plummets. And that means everybody can get their hands on it. So there's this sort of huge burst. Everything gets scented with lemon oil and a little hint of bergamot. Bergamot's the same stuff that they flavour Earl Grey tea with, if you're not familiar with it. And then, of course, so many people are using it, and they've been using it for a while, that becomes old-fashioned. And then the younger generations sort of say, oh, we don't want anything to do with that. And they start looking for more expensive, more exclusive scents that can't be synthesized out of horrible old coal tar. And they go for sort of more complicated musk sorts of smells, which only the very rich can afford. So then you find, finally, that the sort of the lower classes, also wishing to move on from lemon, but unable to afford the new musks, move over to lavender and rose. So you've got this whole sort of evolution of the fashion of smell within the Victorian period. And if you're my age, you know, the smell of lavender is still reminiscent of elderly ladies because it just sort of hung on for such a long time.
How did men keep those spectacular beards and mustaches groomed?
Well, that's what mascara's for. I mean, mascara begins as a moustache wax. Huh. It is just a wax, a dark wax. And then only at the very, very end of the Victorian period, the first women start using it on their eyelashes. But it is a man's grooming product.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jack in Plano. Hi, Jack.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
My question, is about Victorian police forces and how were they trained and what kind of rules did they have to follow?
Okay. Well, they start as a group of people who are there to keep the peace, not to catch criminals. So there had been a very forward-thinking magistrate who had started employing professional thief takers. And then everybody thought that was a great idea, but they thought, well, that's not the whole idea. And the Metropolitan Police first gets set up as a bunch of men who will stand around in the streets in uniform and make everybody behave themselves. They're not there to solve crime. They're there to keep the peace, to walk the beat, to check the locks on people's doors, to keep an eye on how people are behaving, to watch out for known criminals, to see if they're, you know, approaching a property, etc. And the training needed for that was very few, little indeed. What they really did was recruit ex-army men, who they felt would be used to discipline. There was a blanket ban on anybody short. You had to be over a certain height, the idea being that you would be big enough and tough enough to deal with somebody in the street if necessary. Very little training, very little qualifications needed. It was more about being the right sort of chap who could take orders.
It sounds almost like hiring a bouncer for a club today.
Yeah, I think that's quite a good analogy, actually. Sort of public bouncers on the street.
How did people start thinking that it was a good idea to give babies laudanum, which is basically like opium plus alcohol?
Well, what else was there? There wasn't much in the way of medicine available that did any good. And the opiates that were being used to help adults feel better, and they do make you feel better. It might not be doing you any good, but it makes you feel better. We're sort of then transferred onto what you should offer newborns and little teenies. And you know, in a world in which so many teenies died, people were very, very anxious to do their best for their children. So they were, you know, looking for what, you know, the child is in distress, what can I give it to make it feel better? And it seemed obvious that the sorts of things that they were using to make themselves feel better would help the child feel better. And then, of course, there was the idea of soothing syrups. And that comes from a completely different sort of angle. You remember we talked earlier about how young people were having to start work and the pressure on families to have everybody working. That had a sort of knock-on on babies too, in that many mothers with already a large family were struggling to feed that family. A new baby comes along. It's very difficult to stop work and bring less money in because all your children are going hungry. So what do you do with this newborn baby who cries and needs attention? Well, you give it a soothing syrup so that it sleeps longer, so that you can go longer between feeds, so you can get more work done in order to feed your other children. So people start using these soothing syrups, and they were almost exclusively laudanum, which is opium and alcohol mixed together. It does quieten a baby. It makes it sleepy. It stays sleepy for a long period of time. And even when it does feed, it doesn't suck very much. Because one of the things that the opiates do is suppress appetite. You use these things too much and the baby actually starves itself to death because it just stops sucking. Mm. It's pretty grim.
The things that people fed babies seem very strange as well. This always seems like something that should be almost instinctive, but apparently it's not.
It's not, no. I think most people were aware that breast milk was the best option if you had breast milk. But again, many people had to go back to work. You know, it just wasn't all that easy to be at home breastfeeding a baby. Many people's own nutrition was heavily compromised, so they weren't able to produce milk. And of course, people get sick and they can't produce milk. There were lots of reasons why a person might not be able to feed as much as they would want to or at all. And what was considered to be nutritious food was really boils down to bread. Everybody thought that that was the staff of life, the most important, the most nutritious food of all. We're talking about a period before really good scientific analysis had taken place. So people were trying to offer bread and water to babies or bread and milk to babies if they could. There were later on in the period, you know, baby foods that you could buy, but they were not much different from the bread and milk. I mean, they basically consisted of flour that had been baked into a biscuit and then was ground up again and with sugar and served with milk if you had it, water if you didn't. Starch, and more starch.
I guess it fills you up even if it's not giving you many nutrients.
Exactly. And this was it, you know, people recognised bottle-fed or hand-fed babies because they tended to have this very fat, pudgy look about them because they would put on weight because the body can convert starch into other things, but they weren't getting the minerals and the vitamins that they needed. And so they were very unhealthy babies even though they were fat.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Beth on the line now in Sherman. Hi, Beth.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi, I was curious. They have guns by that period, but they're still very extravagant. I was wondering if the art of falconry was still in use by that time.
Falconry? No, it had largely gone. Falconry was only ever something within Britain and Europe that was done by the aristocracy. You weren't allowed to take wild game unless you owned the land, and that's still the case. So if a pigeon flies past or a deer runs past, if you are only the farmer who rents the land, you have no right to that deer, rabbit or whatever it is. And if you take it, that is poaching and against the law. The only people who had the right to kill wild game were those who were landowners, and that's a very tiny percentage of the population. So guns were affordable to those people who were allowed to take the game. Essentially, all sorts of wild hunting were rich man's sports only. It's a very different experience to that which is in America, I understand. Britain having been so settled for so long, all land is owned and every resource is pinned down to the nth degree.
So, Ruth, when you go to the movies and you see, like, something by Dickens or you see Sweeney Todd, what do you think about how accurate do movies tend to get?
They vary enormously.
Do they?
They do vary enormously. And some things people are very good at, and some things people tend to sort of, it slips under the wire quite a lot. I think clothes tend to be either, they fall into two camps, they're either ridiculously posh and clean, mm-hmm. or they're ridiculously rag-like.
Yeah.
And there never seems to be much in the middle.
And people wouldn't have walked down the street unabashedly filthy, right? That just wouldn't have been
exactly,
a thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Self-respect. I mean, that the idea of cleanliness was very heavily ingrained. It was more a matter of how much opportunity did you have to be beautifully turned out. And the images that we have of people show a huge range, and they also show that people are really trying. So take, for example, the photographs of the Pitbrow lasses. These were women who worked on top of the ground in mining. They were after the rules had come into preventing women from working underground. So these are women who are on coal slag heaps sorting coal. It's filthy work. It's outdoors work. It's very heavy work, and it's very poorly paid work. So they haven't got many resources. And when you see photographs of them in their working clothes for 6 days of the week, they are wearing a lot of layers with all the skirts turned right up over what appear to be a pair of trousers. Mm. And it's very heavy clothes. They're very black and dirt encrusted, as you would expect. But they're quite decent cloth. You know, it's not flimsy. There's a lot of bulk and strength and warmth in those fabrics, even though they're quite worn and pretty dirty. The same women also are known to have, and these beautiful images exist, carte de visite. Which are photographs of them in their Sunday best, which may have been pawned all week, but on Sunday they dress like a lady. Hmm. And, you know, it's the cheaper fabrics. It's not the finest silks and so forth, but nonetheless, they are putting on a show on Sunday. You know, they're all tidied up. There's no dirt in evidence. They're all wearing nice skirts. There's none of this rolling up of the skirts and showing trousery things. It's all very, very much more middle classy. And yet, these are women who survive by picking over the coal heaps.
Is there anything we've lost by moving beyond this era that you'd think could make us happier in modern life?
I think the thing I like most is the control of chemicals in my household. I think that's the thing I sort of brought from it most. A Victorian woman didn't go and buy a product; she made her own out of all sorts of things. And there was a huge variety of things available to make the various products. And I like that choice. The fact that, you know, once you've got that knowledge, you can choose which chemicals you want in your house, and you can make the mixes that you're happy with that work for you. And you're not sort of just having to take it on trust that, you know, Joe Bloggs's marvellous product on the supermarket is going to be okay. I like that. Mm. So I feel much empowered by it.
Yeah, they were using like vinegar and borax, that sort of thing.
All sorts of things. I mean, some of it very, very what we might call ecologically sound, and some of it totally scary. Oh, you do not want to have muriatic acid in your home. No, don't do it.
Ruth Goodman is a historian of British social and domestic life and author of How to Be a Victorian, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Victorian Life. Ruth, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.